This weekend, a member of Congress called for people to push back and make clear to those serving their country in this administration that they are not welcome anywhere, anytime, for anything. Healthy debate on ideas and political philosophy is important, but the calls for harassment and push for any Trump supporter to avoid the public is unacceptable. America is a great country, and our ability to find solutions despite those disagreements is what makes us unique. That is exactly what President Trump has done for all Americans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Entry Level Left. My name is Jared.
I'm Matt.
I'm Nathan.
And tonight, we are going to be discussing civility politics. So let's go ahead and get this thing started. What do we mean by civility politics?
So one example I can think of, the Democrats have this saying, you know, when they go low, we go high.
Right.
You guys remember
right,
that?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean to you guys? when they go low, we go high.
Well, I think the point in them like saying something like that is they're trying to highlight this like notion of like, you know, we're going to be the better person and we're always going to meet them halfway and we're always going to be there willing to promote policies in the face of their like sort of, I guess, reactionary hate politics. Yeah. But it really what it means is like, we're not going to do anything substantial to challenge them. We're just going to like try and defeat them with a policy discourse, a civil policy discourse against people who otherwise don't give a shit about any of that.
Yeah. So for people who may not be aware, let me just characterize what the establishment considers civility. And this is from instituteforcivility.org. So, you know, it's a reputable source.
It's a hottake.org.
Yeah. Hottake.org. Anyway, what is civility? Question mark. Civility is about more than just politeness. Although politeness is a necessary first step, it's mostly about disagreement without disrespect. Seeking common ground as a starting point for dialogue about differences, listening to one's past preconceptions, and teaching others to do the same. Civility is the hard work of staying present, even with those with whom we have deep-rooted and fierce disagreements. It is political in the sense that it is a necessary prerequisite for civic action. But it is political, too, in the sense that it is about negotiating interpersonal power such that everyone's voice is heard and nobody is ignored. You know, that's what the establishment thinks of civility politics. But really, what I think highlights civility is this idea that we can entertain even the most gross and disgusting and heinous ideas and give them a platform when they really don't deserve it, you know? So, I mean, when I think of when they go low, we go high, that just means like we try to be more respectable, take the high ground morally. But I mean, there's no such thing as calling things out anymore, you know? The establishment doesn't care when we call out that Trump is a racist or is saying racist things. I mean, like we've said so many times before, the emperor is not wearing any clothes anymore.
Yeah, I think you'll find that today what we see as supposed civil discourse is a myth that's usually useful to like pundits and reactionary types, usually because it distracts from like the core message of a movement and instead can kind of like slate a movement as immoral in a way. Like one of the most recent and clearest examples I can think of is the whole national anthem kneeling Colin Kaepernick fiasco.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired!
Yeah.
Even though the protest was by no means like violent, destructive, or even like hardly distracting. So is it civil? It kind of was civil in a way.
Yeah.
You know, the focus was shifted from conversation about why POCs in the U.S. seem to get shafted by the justice system into, if the football man no stand, the troops will get sad.
Right,
you know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how does that happen?
Yeah.
You know? Well, I think that's the highlights. Like, everything that Colin Kaepernick did, if we're using that example, like, you know, was by all means civil, you know, nonviolent, like, whatever. But the right didn't give a fuck, you know? Like, they still ran with whatever tropes and shit they had to say
about
that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm saying. That's why the high ground and the low ground, it's bullshit. There's no low road and a high road, because ultimately, like as we've seen so many other examples as well, but in this particular situation with Colin Kaepernick, like for all intents and purposes, like his protest was a valid protest and it was for valid reasons and it was a peaceful protest. You know, he wasn't out in the middle of the street with pitchforks and like trying to burn cars.
Hurt.
I mean, if for all intents and purposes, it is exactly what a peaceful protest should entail. But when right-wing pundits and the internet and Fox News culture tries to take these things and warp them into a hatred for America or these type of things, what that is like signaling is like, it's not an America in the sense that you, me, or Jared think about. It's America in a sense that we're losing this like white ethnostate or white monopoly that we have on politics, and conservatives are afraid of that.
They're kind of slipping in like the conclusion with their argument. Like the idea of civility in this case was like, you have to respect the troops. You know what I mean? If you don't respect the troops, if you don't respect the flag, then we're not going to engage with you at all. It's a way of disengaging.
Yeah, and I think the alternative side to that, the like sort of civility side that I think you were talking about earlier with the more like liberal establishment, going back to that, when, you know, they go low, we go high, then means virtually like when in the face of that deep reaction, when we all know that like people who had an issue with Colin Kaepernick's like protests, for instance, were obviously upset about this affront to white power in the United States. Instead of liberals having a backbone, for instance, to say like, hey, like, fuck you, he has a right to do this stuff, and we fundamentally support him, and their interest of remaining civil and in the center, they were like, oh, well, you know, I see his point, but maybe this isn't the right way to go about it because it makes the troops feel bad or whatever. When in reality, it's like, hold the fucking line, you know, because these people don't give a shit either which way. They're going to call you a, you know, harebrained socialist commie trying to undermine.
Right.
And half the time it's like blatantly two-faced, because like today, literally, Trump tweeted that Congressman Elijah Cummins is a, quote, brutal bully, then went on to say that his district is rodent infested, which sounds like a dog whistle to me, disgusting and more dangerous than even the southern border.
Right.
So for Trump and other more like extreme elements of his government and especially his base, the calls for civility are just kind of like a throwaway talking point. It's just another name to call somebody on TV, or like a really good way to just dodge a question.
It's just a distraction.
Exactly.
To get people to think that, well, to get people to fall into this trap that they're deserving of civility no matter what, like no matter even if they're going to say the most heinous racist shit. And even then, like they'll say this stuff and then they'll backpedal. And they'll act as if what they're saying is not racist, or even they'll have people in the Democratic establishment agree with them. Wasn't it Pelosi that said about Trump's racist comments that this isn't a thesaurus, you know, saying something about, you know, a dictionary has like this word in it, but a dictionary isn't racist.
She had said, like it wasn't that Trump is racist.
Yeah.
It's that he was using racist words.
By the way, we were offended that he spoke in such a way about members of Congress, but we're offended that he says that about people across the country all the time. Go back where you came from. And that, is, by its definition, those words are racism. You go look in the AP and other places where they define certain words. That's what that is. But we weren't saying that he was racist. We were saying that the words that he used were racist. So that was as gentle as it could be.
Right.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, to that end, what people need to understand is, like, this is what civility politics do in the real world. It gets people to disconnect context and intent from language and from culture and from different things like this, to the effect that they go and they say, they'll side with Pelosi and say, well, you know, she's right, you know, just because he's using that language doesn't mean that he's a racist. And Jared has said it before, like a lot of liberals and a lot of like establishment Democrats or people like that, they won't believe that someone is a racist or a Nazi unless they're literally gassing Jewish people
or in a Klan robe
or in a Klan robe. And like the optics have to be so strong and so attached to typical tropes of these things that, you know, we sort of lose sight about where these things come from and how they bubble up in culture. Just to, you know, be succinct about that issue where, you know, Pelosi was saying that Trump is not being racist. A difference between a dictionary is like declaring a definition for a word in common usage or context, you know, but when a person, an individual uses words, they're naturally taking on a political context, and especially in the way that Trump uses those words in an undoubtedly and demonstrably derogatory way. You cannot like rationally say that there is no type of racist intention or some type of a biased intention in the way that he's framing that language. So it's just bunk for her to say that. And that's kind of what civility politics does in the real world.
Right. So I think we've kind of gone over like what civility politics is and how it's kind of been used in practice now in the modern age. But how would we say that appeals to civility politics in the U.S. have been used historically, maybe in the instance to, you know, pacify the American public and more specifically the working class under capitalism?
I was thinking about this question earlier, and what dawned on me was a quote by Assata Shakur. And I'm going to paraphrase it, but basically what she says is no one has ever made gains by appealing to the morality of their oppressor. And I think that's like the perfect takeaway from this particular question, because historically, if we really look at it, I mean, there's never really been an instance where people or the masses have made appeals to, you know, an oppressor or a government or a structure like that, where they've made moral appeals and won gains that way. It's always been moral appeals in conjunction with, you know, work stoppage or strikes or different things like that. It's never just by the moral appeal alone of an argument or of a movement that we win gains. It's always in conjunction with something else. You see that all throughout history, but I mean, the civil rights era is a prominent display of this, where for the most part, there were peaceful displays. And, you know, around the era of the Vietnam War, you see people lighting themselves on fire to make, you know, what we'd consider symbolic demonstrations of peaceful protest. But that's the thing with those peaceful protests. Like, they are symbolic, but is symbolism enough on its own to be able to push forward an agenda or make a point?
Well, even in the instances of like the civil rights, right? I mean, virtually every single time that there was a protest or an affront to American racism that was happening at that time, it was, I'm going to sit in a part of a bus that I'm not supposed to sit in. I'm going to sit at a restaurant in an area that says white only, and
I counters, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or we're going to go on a march from this place to this place. And what was it met with every time? If not like just ridicule and harassment and papers being ran in towns for weeks on end about the communist threat in a, you know, globally paying these people to, or they're all spies. Or they were literally clubbed to death in the streets
or
by the cops, by the Klan, by just sympathetic, you know, whites at the time to the white supremacist cause who found these people to be horrendous. It's like basically what we're getting at is, and just as we were talking about more modern examples with Colin Kaepernick, all of these civil displays of disobedience in the face of inequality, racism, whatever the case may be, are almost always met with state violence, denunciation, you name it.
Yeah.
Then we are constantly lectured to when we don't abide by those norms because we're frustrated and we're mad and we see that it doesn't change anything structurally long term, we're then told we need to be more civil. So whether you're civil or you're uncivil, either way, both historically and now, you are painted as a radical, a terrorist, someone trying to undermine American values, ABC, XYZ.
The important thing to note for a listener is like with every one of these occurrences, there's always some type of a norm. There's always some type of a norm that is trying to be conserved in culture. Whether this norm is a reality or an idealistic sense, like when you think of the American dream or you think of neoliberalism as an idea or a political project, there's always this idea that these things are norms or American values are some type of static norm that people adhere to. And I think that is part of the mystification of civility politics as well. They work as like a cultural like component to sort of mystify these elements of phenomena, history, government policy. But really, like, we have to look at history and look at these issues and ask ourselves clearly, like, do we have a unified American culture? Do we have unified American values? Or have we always been split on these things? And then once you get to that point, you can really say, well, where does civility come in? You know, the establishment thinks of civility in this way where we're constantly, a term that Democrats love to use, like reaching across the aisle, right?
Right.
Always trying to compromise with the right-wing side of the government when in reality, like, the majority of the base that votes for Democrats or progressives, they side with, like, policies that a lot of right-wing Americans would consider, like, outright democratic socialism or socialism. Like, you know, the policies of Bernie Sanders and some other progressives, these policies are wildly popular with the majority of, like, working-class Americans.
Right.
But, you know,
majority of Americans,
yeah,
period.
Yeah, yeah, Americans, period. But the real mystification is that these media outlets, through civility politics and other things that they employ, they get us to look at these things in a mystifying way and think of them in a cultural way rather than just like a political platform tied to real economic gains for people. But that's like the problem with civility politics. Like, this idea throughout history and throughout politics, throughout humankind, that we can be simply civil or nonviolent and make gains is not true. Like, violence doesn't have to be in the sense where, you know, I'm literally bludgeoning you to death with a club because, you know, you withheld wages from me,
right,
you
right.
know, and, you know, I'm a factory worker and I've got my pitchfork. But violence can also be in the sense where labor is stopping production. Like, that's considered like a sort of an economic violence towards the ruling class.
Right.
Because the ruling class loves civility politics. They employ them all the time for, you know, a myriad of different reasons. But when you have a ruling class and a hierarchical structure under capitalism, as we constantly talk about, who do you think the civility politics or civility as a political program, who do you think that benefits? The people with less power? You know, in the hierarchy, the people with less control of the means of production? Or do you think that benefits more the people that have control of the means of production?
Yeah, there seems to be like this certain myth that we've never been perfect, but we've always fixed it in the long run.
Right.
And that kind of like leads this credence to the idea that like we can just talk it through, right? And we'll make it.
Right.
But the truth is when you take like a survey of American history, even going all the way back to like, for example, colonial rule by the English government, you know, that was solved with war. You know, taxation without representation
right.
was solved with war. Emancipation of slaves was solved with war. The abolishment of sweatshop conditions in America was achieved with rowdy unions and massive strikes.
And a lot of people dying.
Yeah, literally yeah. people dying. Yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah. Women's suffrage was achieved with like public demonstrations and even like burning speeches in front of the White House. Marches and sit-ins for civil rights, riots for gay liberation, the list goes on and on. So we should never expect that like any sort of reactionary force is just going to give an inch. You know,
right.
they never will. You have to right. fight for every single inch.
A perfect highlight of all of what you just said, what you said, what we've been talking about up to this point is literally the 8 years of the Obama presidency. I mean, you're talking about every single issue. They caved. The Obama administration caved 100%, or rather would give the Republican Party 99% of what it wanted. But because they didn't get 100%, they would shut the fucking government down. They would just play such rigorous hardball that they would rather have nothing than any compromise.
Right.
And it's like that kind of, you know, that kind of politics, quite honestly, works.
It works.
Does work. It has worked so successfully for the right. But the Obama administration for 8 years kept trying to meet halfway with these people under the guise of civility politics. And it's the reason why instead of Medicare for All, we got a health insurance bill written by the health insurance industries that all it does is fine people outrageous amounts of money for
being
not,
poor,
for being poor and not being able to afford ludicrous and what should be illegal practices by healthcare industries. And the list goes on. There's so many issues where there were things that instead of taking a true stance on, we wanted to meet halfway and we got nothing because of it for yeah. 8 years. And that's all I need to know about civility politics, having grown up in that era.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. as famous socialist revolutionary and Antifa Supreme Chancellor Hillary Clinton once said, you cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for.
This is my fight song. Take back my life song.
Hot so, take I from mean, Clinton.
That's the thing, is she's not wrong. Like, we really don't have time
right.
to be debating decorum when kids are like in camps and corporations are like
right.
sucking the life out of every corner of existence, you know?
Right. And I think that's why Trump has been so effective. I mean, to his base, why he's so popular and all that is he's doing everything that he said he was going to do.
Yeah, I mean, the right
has
a clear program. I mean, right. I don't understand why liberals are so confused by what they're like. They're so outraged and shocked by what the right is doing, but the right has never made like they've never made appeals to be anything different. Like they've been this way,
right?
And they're not doing anything that's outside of character. They're literally doing exactly what they want to do. And the reason Trump is popular is because he's not afraid to just do it and not be worried about the Democrats calling him uncivil. Like he literally doesn't care because they have control over the government. They can do whatever they want.
I mean, I think this is actually a good segue. So in the age of Trump, we often hear a lot of, you know, as we were kind of saying before, you know, political elites and pundits from all sides of the American body politic requesting that Americans either regain their civility with one another or be more civil with ideas they do not agree with, claiming that American politics have become too polarized and that in turn we need a more middle of the road centrist politics. Does the group agree with this? Why or why not?
Fuck yeah.
No, I mean, obviously not, but if...
You're not all radical centrists?
No. Fully automated luxury class radical centrism. The thing is like, if you look at a very current example, like if you look at the presidential nominee race for the Democratic Party right now, you have so many different random ass people that are running to be nominated for the primary. You've got Joe Biden, you've got Kamala Cop Harris, you've got Pete Buttigieg, you've got even people like Andrew Yang that we were talking about earlier. And, you know, we talked about his interview on Chapo a little bit. But the funny thing is like I found myself agreeing with a lot of what he has to say. And I think he's a rational guy. Jared, what you said is like he didn't seem to really go into a lot of things. And it seemed like he lacked like clear knowledge on a lot of these things that they were asking him, even though they didn't really grill him that hard. But the thing about centrism is like all of these nominees for the Democratic primary are literally centrist. Like Joe Biden, he wanted to build a wall like back in 2007. Right. Like he's been against busing and integration, you know, from the start of his career. And this guy is like literally a blue Trump. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's the
he's
way I look at him. I mean, there's nothing substantially different between Joe Biden and Trump, except one wears a blue tie, one wears a red tie. And that's the way that I look at centrism and centrism clouded in this idea of civility politics and how these people are doing things like Cory Booker is on stage saying, I really want to punch Trump because my testosterone levels are out of control. And I like my T levels are great. Like I'm a real man, like a you
big
know,
dick.
Yeah. Saying this like stuff that he thinks is like big dick energy, but it's really just really cringy.
Donald Trump is a guy who you understand he hurts you. And my testosterone sometimes makes me want to feel like punching him, and which would be bad for this elderly out of shape man that he is if I did that. This physically awesome. Physically weak specimen.
Surely this will make the Republicans flip sides.
Yes, surely this will win over like every Republican because, you know, all they really care about is like tough guy syndrome. But anyway.
Right. As they're wheeling through a Walmart in their scooter.
Yeah, as they've got like a fucking like AK-47 strapped to their back in the middle of a Target Supercenter, like looking at frozen meat. Anyway, that's none of my business. Like, Biden is challenging Trump to a push-up contest on stage.
Come on, Donald. Come on, man. How many push-ups you want to do here, pal?
Just all of this complete fucking nonsense that literally means nothing. While people are dying in cages and while, you know, we're killing brown people with drones over in the Middle East and giving weapons deals and contracts to a despot in Saudi Arabia. And all of this stuff goes under the radar when we've got people like Cory Booker and Trump and Biden, these like freakish, ghoulish people that are just basically having a dick measuring contest while the world burns, you
right,
know?
Yes.
But that's civility politics. That's centrism. Will get you to look at these things and equivocate what the radical right wants with what the radical left wants. What's radical about what the left wants, you know? Right. What's radical about what the right wants? Well, for the majority of far-right extremists, like, we've seen what they want. They're telling us what they want. We should believe them when they shoot up a mosque and live stream it like we've talked about, when they rampantly kill people that are just different from them for no reason, when they graffiti a Jewish temple, or when they try to go to a synagogue and write graffiti on it, or you know that story where the guy like tried to light the synagogue on fire,
right, or they just go in the synagogue and kill the people in there.
Yeah, and it's like, this is what the right is telling us that they want. Whereas, you know, you have people like Ted Cruz and all these right-wing pundits that are trying to criminalize Antifa and,
right.
you know, trying to criminalize or make Antifa out to be a terrorist organization when it has no real hierarchical structure, no real organization.
And has never committed a substantial act of violence yeah, on U.S. soil.
Yeah. They've never really done anything. There's no confirmed kills. There's nothing. I mean, Antifa is, for all intents and purposes, a very liberal and segmented and non-organized organization.
And adventurous. Like, organization. Yeah, it's, yeah. But I mean, my thing is, when I hear about this, we need to be more civil with one another and we need a more politics of the center. And you have these dumbass fools on the internet thinking that they're so edgy for calling themselves radical centrists. My question is, what outline for me, I want a detailed outline of what is a political program of a centrist. Because, like, there are no policies, number one, that the Democrats can even manage to enact or have yeah. substantially enacted in the past, 12 years or whatever. Okay, that's number one. The right continues to do crazy radical shit, and the idea of a center between the two is just maybe slightly less crazy radical shit, and... In the U.S., we already have one party that's so radically far off to the right. The fact that Trump even got elected should have thrown out any notion of there ever being a quote-unquote political center ever again. Trump is the magnum opus of where the Republican Party has been headed for the past 20 fucking years.
And even the Never Trumper people, like, they agree with like 99.9% of what he's doing. Yeah, yeah.
And they're not Never Trumpers. They are voting for Trump.
Yeah.
I don't care how many fucking think pieces David Brooks wants to write. I don't give a shit about how many college Republicans they pull on MSNBC to say, well, I think the Democratic Party's progressive left is too radical. Biden appeals more to me, even though I'm still voting for Trump. Then fuck you. Like, I don't give a fuck about your policy initiatives. I don't give a fuck about what you think is important. I don't give a fuck about what candidate support. Literally fuck off. You have no...
You stand for nothing.
You stand for nothing. There is no reason why any Democrat in America should give a shit about your stupid ass think piece or poll result or whatever, because it's not going to drive any result in a political election for the Democratic Party, because you're all going to vote for Trump anyway.
Well, I mean, it's kind of ironic because, like, we're making a podcast right now, but politics and this type of stuff has become sort of like entertainment for bourgeois elements in society.
Right.
And that's really what it is. Like, that's what I see centrism is, just like an entertainment for people that will never, ever, ever be affected materially by the outcome of a Biden presidency versus a Trump presidency.
Right.
Like, the majority of the people who have centrist views will never stand to lose or really gain anything from either one of those people right. being in office.
And
their privilege remains mostly unchanged.
Yeah, their lives have not changed under Trump at all.
Yeah,
at
I mean, my life really hasn't changed too much, but the thing is like, it could be a lot fucking better too.
Right.
And I recognize that. And I think, like, if you are listening to this and you consider yourself someone that comes from bourgeois or petty bourgeois roots, you know, someone who maybe comes from parents that were small business owners or things like that. If you come from those roots, like, you really have to recognize that, you know, while your life maybe hasn't changed too much, that's all the more reason to recognize the privilege that you do have and be talking to people who don't experience things in the same way. Like, if we should have civility at all, like on the left, we should be using it as a vehicle to discuss these things with people who are different from us and who would gain so much from
right.
changing the system that we have, instead of continually giving up to centrist politics and letting the right establish what is a norm, rather than having a unified political program on the left where we say no, like being against abortion and trying to overturn Roe v. Wade and trying to gut regulations on banks, trying to privatize everything, that is actually a far right concept, and we shouldn't allow that. Like, we should
just, and we should not meet halfway with that at all.
I mean, that's to me what a legitimate left wing or even a liberal, because I think of that as more a liberal
thing. Right.
You know, more leftist things would be, hey, let's nationalize the energy sector. Let's nationalize all banks. Let's make it so investment companies or insurance companies cannot make profit on people this way.
All right, I think this sort of points towards some of like the core issues that leftists have with like the punditry class, especially like the mainstream media.
Right.
There's like no major outlet in print, on the radio, on cable, even like online outlets really that are fully anti-capital. Every single reporter, every single person who's writing an article, they report to an editor who reports to some C-level executive who reports to a board of directors. None of them want things to be shaken up too much. You know what I mean? Even if they are like a little bit reformist or a little bit extra liberal, very left-wing paper, they're not somebody who wants to just shake things up. Like you said, nationalizing industries. They're probably just fine with the way things are. They're always going to play it safe and minimize risk. The truth is no one wants to be the news organization that calls for mass protests, because if something goes wrong,
right,
they're the ones who are going to be
blamed for it. They lose money,
You know, especially like Fox News. They're never going to let it down. It's always going to be, oh, remember that time CNN actually endorsed Black Lives Matter or endorsed Antifa? Well, we're never going to let them live that down. Kind of naturally, all the other liberal news organizations follow suit because they don't want to stick out. They don't want to be the one that's different. And meanwhile, on the other end of the spectrum, Fox News and other right-wing organizations have literally no problem about releasing a dozen stories in the same day about Antifa throwing too many milkshakes or whatever, while spending months ignoring the fact that right-wing terrorism is an actual threat. Sadly, liberal organizations like CNN see that coverage and they think, well, we have to have an opinion on that too. Right. And so they spend so much resources and so much time, and they build these panels of 9 different people with like Ann Coulter and Sheriff Joe or some shit on those panels weighing in on why Antifa may or may not be an extremist threat that the U.S. should declare a terrorist organization or whatever. It doesn't matter. I mean, it changes every single week with something new. You know what I mean? But in the end, it's always kind of like these companies have a bias towards the status quo. You know, they don't want things to be shaken up too much.
Right. I mean, why would they? They're profit-seeking enterprises. Yeah. What do profit-seeking enterprises have to gain from
anything? And politicians aren't, like, immune to that either. They watch these media organizations set the tone, and they follow that tone. And then they also, you know, are subject to the whim of all their donors as well, which are usually capitalists.
So I think we're kind of getting at this then a little bit. What are the goals, then, would we say, of civility politics and the politics of centrism, their achievements, if any, and why are both so keen on, you know, kind of propagating far right versus far left horseshoe theory on virtually every platform they're given?
We were sort of getting to this point, but we talk about where Nathan was sort of leading with that. Take, for example, in recent news where several people on the right are calling for, you know, what Ocasio-Cortez needs or what Ilhan Omar needs is like a bullet.
A Gretna police officer posted a comment on his Facebook page this past week calling for Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, calling her a vile idiot who needs a round. And I don't mean the kind she used to serve as a waitress.
Carlino made death threats in a phone call to Omar's office on March 21st. Carlino said to a staffer over the phone, "Do you work for the Muslim Brotherhood? Why are you working for her? She's a terrorist. I'll put a bullet in her skull."
How is this not taken as like an affront to democracy? Like, if these people, these free speech people, really cared about free speech, like, and not just dog whistling to signal other racists, like, if these people were consistent in their values, don't you think that they would be standing up for the free speech of everybody? No, they are not standing up for the free speech of everybody. They're standing up for free speech against the left. It's clearly in a context of, we want free speech for our group, but we're going to suppress you because what you're saying has no validity, and we want to suppress what you're saying. Like, where you get these things like Ted Cruz wanting to label Antifa as a terrorist organization. You know, no one talks about labeling the KKK or, you know, Stormfront or these websites like Breitbart as like terrorist organization or, you know, terrorist incubation cells. No one talks about that stuff. But time and time again, these institutions are creating literal terrorists, literal school shooters, and, you know, the statistics are out there. I mean, I won't even really have to broach the subject. I mean, if you are unconvinced at this point in time that the majority of violent terrorism in this country is propagated by right-wing pundits and right-wing ideology, you're just really not paying attention. And we'll put resources in the show notes, but the thing is, like, this is what civility politics and centrism produces. These are the goals of these things: to equate far left and far right politics and their initiatives and their goals. But they couldn't be any more different. Like Antifa, while not organized in any real way, they're trying to be sort of like a group that is pushing back against these far right organizers. And these are the people out in the streets that are showing up and protesting against Patriot Prayer and these people, you know, like in Oregon and these far right groups and the Proud Boys and all of these groups. These are the people that are showing up and protesting these groups. It's not because they don't want free speech. It's because they literally think that the speech that these groups are promoting on the right is harmful. It's like demonstrably harmful because, you know, we've seen the rhetoric and we've seen these things develop in the real world to come to fruition in violent massacres, school shootings. I don't know, at what point do you start to just call people on their bullshit, where like Ben Shapiro or Candace Owens were literally by name referenced in the Shooter's right. Manifesto. At what point do these people have to take responsibility for the fact that whether or not they believe themselves to be promoting this type of violence, like at what point do they take responsibility for the fact that someone is twisting that narrative around or taking it and internalizing it and making it into a violent thing? Whereas like, where do you see people in the world saying, oh, I shot up a synagogue because Noam Chomsky taught me about radical politics on YouTube? You know, like, you don't see that happening. Like, give me one example where you see Michael Parenti or Richard Wolf being in an Antifa manifesto of some Antifa person like shooting up a Starbucks or right. anything. Like, give me any example where you can equivocate these things and then we can have a real conversation about it. But until that point, it's just, it's clear bullshit and cultural framing on the part of the right. The right, they have so much institutional power. Really, the only thing that they have to throw or fling mud against the left about is these cultural politics. And the right doesn't have like a real unified understanding of leftist or even liberal politics, really, because they don't see things from the left side, because the left, like I said earlier, does not have an institutional framework in this country. Like, there's no institutional power for real leftists in this country. Like, we have neoliberal, we have centrist politics that have, you know, institutional force in this country with the media and, you know, CNN and all that stuff. But the left, the real left, does not have any institutional power. And I think that's why the right is so successful in taking these cultural narratives and then bending them to be like critiques of like an institutional left that does not exist.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. The far right, when I say the far right, I mean far right on major platforms like Fox News, whatever. They are out here radicalizing all these different people, and these people are going out and actually committing heinous acts of violence. If someone on the left, like even a like Democratic lawmaker, like say tomorrow Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out and all she would have to do is say the Soviet Union was really bad, but not everything it did was bad, she would literally be basically forced to fucking resign.
Yeah, meanwhile, she would be called out.
Yeah, meanwhile, we have a far right that can say shit or be actually called out as being provocateurs by the person committing a heinous act of violence for the reason why they're doing X, Y, and Z to however many people. It may be talked about or discussed, but at the end of the day, even those liberal news networks will come back to, as they always do, with some centrist shithead on there who's like, you know, this is just more reason why we need more civil discourse in the U.S. because the left is too left and the right is too right. What fucking left? What left? And what left that you know that exists? What? Name me one who has done anything other than throw a goddamn milkshake at someone or punch a fucking Nazi.
Reactionary elements of society, they literally want their political opponents to value civility.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It goes back to what you said earlier. It's like, should we really take suggestions on tactics from our opposition?
Right.
That's why, like, Joe Biden wants you to know that he was golf buddies with that segregationist guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
He's trying to get brownie points with people who are 100% never going to go vote for him, or trying to get points with the center, right? Or people who absolutely want nothing but the world to be exactly the same as it was yesterday.
But the thing about, like, for example, with Trump, I mean, when he said those, like, absolutely outwardly racist things.
If you're not happy here, you can leave. And that's what I say all the time. That's what I said in a tweet, which I guess some people think is controversial. A lot of people love it, by the way.
He didn't quite repeat it the way he'd said it on Twitter. In his tweets, Donald Trump took aim at progressive Democrat congresswomen who he claimed originally came from countries whose governments are a catastrophe. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?
His approval ratings actually went up.
Right.
I mean, so it shows you that people, like, want him to say these things. Like, there are people that identify with what he's saying.
The president's supporters in North Carolina turned his racist tweet into a rallying cry.
And I mean, that should be clear enough to some liberals that are, you know, centrists or people that think that there is some type of a moral high ground. There isn't. I mean, these people will go low and they'll continue to go low. And by you going high, they're not going to recognize that. Like, you're not going to tame these people into, you know, adhering to your morality. Because they don't care, and they realize that they don't have to care to win ground.
And if you want to actually go high, quote unquote, go high on the matter, then you propose a radical alternative to the propositions being made by that
right,
low
by the right,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Not developing a more cleverly crafted narrative.
Yeah, where like Kamala Harris's response to like debt forgiveness for all student loans is like, if you have a small business that you've run for 3 years and you're a Pell Grant recipient, we'll consider forgiving all your student debt if you are operating in an underprivileged community. How much more of a bullshit platform can you have? First of all, that's maybe like five people
right,
in the whole
world
that's going to benefit from that policy. But second of all, look at what she's incentivizing with that policy. Incentivizing people to just make small businesses and continue the status quo and just ignore what big corporations are doing. Like, you know, how does that policy disrupt anything that Wall Street is doing, that, you know, corporations are doing? It doesn't. It just gets people to go back to this idea of like strengthening communities through small business ownership, but it doesn't look at anything super structural. Like, small business ownership isn't going to solve poverty. It's not going to change capitalism and remove the hierarchical structure of the way capitalism produces and the way capitalism requires poverty to exist on a superstructural level. Capitalism requires a liquid labor pool. It requires people to be in desperation for low wages. It requires these things. And centrism and civility politics does just that. It gets people to ignore the superstructural issues and to be complacent with these, you know, calls for civility or these incremental changes that ultimately will just get pushed back because our opposition, namely the right or the far right in this context, they don't play that way. Like, they're not about incremental change. They want to remove abortion. They want to take away women's rights. They want women to be like, you know, in the house doing home labor and doing, you know, labor that is not even considered real work
right
to these people. And these are the platforms that these people run on,
yeah.
And they're not apologetic about it. And liberals thinking that they can play this game of civility is just, it's never worked, it will never work, and it's a complete waste of time.
And these people that advocate for platforms like Matt's describing, whether it's like the pundits on TV like Tucker Carlson, or if it's Mitch McConnell, or if it's like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, they all want to be able to raise that platform and promote that platform until 5 p.m. And then they want to go home and not be bothered. And
right.
That's exactly where you have power, is the fact that when these people go out in public
right.
and they're made uncomfortable by the fact that they are who they are,
right.
that is where you're winning. These
right.
people can't last forever.
Right.
Okay, if you go out and you actually really, really make people uncomfortable,
right.
whether it is before 5 p.m. or after
right.
5 p.m. when they go home, it doesn't matter. Look at Puerto Rico.
Right.
I mean, a million people stormed the Capitol and the governor resigned.
Right.
You can only last so long when
right.
there's a real popular force working against
right.
you.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example.
Yeah,
I mean, the protests in Puerto Rico over the governor, who, for our listeners that may not be aware, you know, there were text communications leaked from the governor of Puerto Rico, and he was saying a bunch of homophobic and misogynistic shit. He was making fun of like people that died in Maria and just completely being a shithead. And, you know, so many people, I would say like the statistic was about a third of all Puerto Ricans. Like,
I think it was a
million people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the streets for consecutive days, you know, organizing. I mean, it was not really, there was no ideology right. for the movement, but it was such a widespread movement that it didn't really need an ideology to be successful at what it garnered.
They didn't give up either, because what happened first was he said, I'm not going to rerun, but they didn't leave. They stayed.
Yeah.
They kept fighting. And then he said, okay, I'm going to retire, or not retire, I'm going to resign at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed. He resigned that fucking night.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. So the mass mobilization of the people against the ruling classes fucking works. It works every time. History shows this to be the case. Had that been drawn out longer than what it was, what would have been the pundits' takes on the Puerto Rico matter or whatever? Well, you know, there's a better way to handle this. Maybe instead of getting too rowdy and crowding the streets and leaving these dirty trash and all this shit everywhere.
Yeah, we'll just teach,
maybe they can just vote. They'll just bring out and turn out the vote. Right. And that's exactly what happened in 2010 with that Scott Walker shit when he passed the right to work laws over there. And they fucking lost, because instead of staying and occupying and continuing that, all those fucking centrist liberal fucking, you know, nonprofits or whatever got in there and says, no, we need to not occupy the state house anymore. We need to go with a referendum. And guess what? It fucking failed. And it strengthened him and strengthened his base. And he ran on how anti-union he was and how easy it was for him to crush dissent from the radical left. And he was reelected. And that's exactly what's going to happen with Trump if we continue to run on this centrist bullshit.
That's what civility politics do. It gets us to equivocate these things and constantly, you know, kowtow to the people that are in charge, and the people that are in charge are the far right. We're not taught our history. We're not taught these things well enough to be able to understand that the United States of America is a far right government, is a far right institution, and it exists as a far right and extreme right force in the world. I mean, there's nothing left about the U.S. There's nothing left about liberal politics, and there's nothing left about political centrism. And these ideas that we can constantly reach across the aisle, they've not got us anywhere. But with the example with Puerto Rico, going back just real quick, what would have happened if the people of Puerto Rico conceded to civility, or had a culture in America like we do, where people are so complacent and prone to give way to civility and allow it to, you know, infect the political discourse and confuse people and obfuscate things and just get people to be apathetic towards, you know, real change? Then that movement in Puerto Rico wouldn't have been as effective. It wouldn't have worked. Now, granted, the conditions economically in Puerto Rico are different. Puerto Rico exists as a consumer mostly for U.S. production. So they're kind of like an economic colony in the sense that they don't have a lot of like independence over their production. They exist mainly as a colony for U.S. producers to export over to Puerto Rico. So their economic conditions are very different than the mainland U.S. And so that creates different cultural values and different cultural phenomena. And I think that's maybe one characteristic of Puerto Rico that makes them less prone to believing the bullshit of civility politics and more prone to keep this extended or this distended protest up so that they win real gains and get this guy to resign. You know, whereas in the U.S., you know, we have performative politics, or what we were talking about earlier with optics, like performative politics in the sense that you don't really care about the outcome. You're just looking for clout, or you're just looking for validation from other people with like-minded views, but you don't have an organized political platform, you don't have an ideology, and you're not really trying to win gains. You're just performing for other people for a spectacle, for them to, you know, give you clout. Or in terms of optics, you want to just appear in a way that is woke or radical, but you don't actually believe those things or work towards those things. You just want to appear that you do. And that's the state of American politics today. You know, if we compare to, you know, different conditions in different places, that Puerto Rico is not a socialist country. It's not in any way, you know, a leftist country. I mean, it's very much in the grip of sort of an economic junta and capitalist hegemony. I mean, they're no different than the U.S. in that sense, but they do have different characteristics. Anyway, so in 2004, centrist poster boy Barack Obama once famously said that there was no red and blue America, and that we needed to come together and be more civil with one another to get things done. So under his later presidency, while appealing to centrist liberal ideals and civility politics, he presided over an expansion of the security state, imperial efforts abroad, the bailout of Wall Street, and even the rise of Black Lives Matter, for which he regularly distanced himself throughout his entire presidency. To the group, I want to pose a question. How is this phenomena with Barack Obama specifically a reflection of civility politics and political centrism in practice versus in theory, as we've talked about?
Yeah, so I think, as we've kind of been alluding to, is like what centrist politics more so is in theory. It's like it's this idea that, you know, we have this strong, vibrant center where we meet halfway with the opposing sides and we get things done because of the fact that the two sides are coming together and at least getting 50-50 of what they want as opposed to 100, but something's ultimately getting done, right? So Obama kind of runs on this, you know, hope and change, making America work again with one another, you know, at the post-Bush era. And I think political centrism still continues to regurgitate itself in that fashion of, you know, meeting halfway and trying to not try and get too crazy with what you want done. But I think in practice, what it ultimately does is it just continues to reinforce the underlying structural reaction and reactionary practices and policies of the ruling class long term. Because as we were talking about, or as you alluded to in that question, Obama oversaw literally the exact same thing that happened under Bush, with the exception of passing a healthcare bill, you know, and a shitty healthcare bill at that. And so what political centrism does in practice is just continue what is already wrong, that people feel is wrong and affects their literal material realities on a daily basis, to continue to occur, propagate, and even get worse. But the optics are different. Instead of actively being pro-war or, you know, anti-union or something like that, it appeals to and appears as though it's not those things and even says it's not those things. But in many ways, either in meeting halfway with that side that does want all those things to be got rid of or is pro-war or something like that, continues to propagate those policies long term.
And like a specific example of the meeting halfway, a lot of people have been mystified and just very much taken by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example. And in a lot of ways, she does express very progressive views, but in some other ways, she doesn't. So, for example, she recently joined House Democrats in a vote for Trump's war budget. So, I mean, this is not just amusing. This is not just like a speculation or some type of conspiracy theory, but in a very real sense, elements of like establishment Democrat politics will reach across the aisle and side with things that most people should consider the Democrats to be vehemently against, which is war, which is things like this. But, you know, when we look at moneyed politics and we look at the interests and we look at capitalism and how those processes pan out, Democrats are capitalists just the same as Republicans. And a lot of them, if they're in the business of weapons contracting, they're making money off of these terribly heinous fucking things as well. So it's really a matter of so many different things, economics, culture, but it's a meeting halfway with the worst elements of our society. And what it allows the American public to do, or not do rather, is take a real stand on a real political platform and have a real cohesive view of what is wrong and what is right. Really, civility politics should be thought of in the sense of like a moral equivalency or a moral justification of being unethical, of siding with things that are problematic just because they're the status quo.
Right. And in turn comes with that a long-term pacification, I think, of working people in America.
So I think the perfect example during the Obama administration of seeing the right completely pivot once the left is making any sort of progress is Obamacare, right? Mm-hmm. The public option was the biggest part of Obama's policy proposal.
Right.
That was the part people were voting for. That was the change. That was the hope. All the stuff that we thought was really going to change America, right? And for just years, before this is coming up to, you know, through the 2008 election and then finally to 2010 when they pass it, you can't hear enough of Republican pundits talking about how a public option means socialism, how they're gonna socialize medicine,
death panels,
panels and yada yada yada. They finally pass a milquetoast version of a bill that is an exact replica of a Republican bill passed on the state level previously by Mitt Romney, right?
Romney Care.
Who ironically ran against Obama, right?
Right, right.
And then when they adopt this kind of Republican-esque, like really pro-capital, pro-insurance company bill, they pivot completely to saying, no, 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 that's socialism too. This is a complete disaster. This is what happens when the government gets involved.
Right.
Which is insane. And this is just demonstrating that no matter what you do, no matter how much you cave in, and no matter how far you try to shoot down the center, they're always going to pivot and go even more extreme than you could ever imagine.
They'll show you what their real values are, and you know they'll always twist the narrative to suit what it is their ends are. This idea that there is like a static high ground or low ground is complete bullshit.
So to kind of wrap these points up and whatnot, you know, what are some other ways in which civility politics and, you know, the American center reinforce capitalism, more specifically neoliberal capitalism, in the modern age?
Well, you talked about it a little bit briefly when Nathan commented about Romney Care, quote unquote, and how it was kind of written for the benefit of insurance companies and for capital. So, I mean, it's clear to me, at least in the relatively narrow context that we're talking, like a span of 8 years or, you know, the last 20 years, but it's relatively clear to me how the status quo is distinctly right wing. Even if it's not far right, it's milquetoast or lukewarm right-wing politics when we look at Obama's administration and how he originally ran on a very progressive platform, but then when he's in office, you know, they kowtow to all this stuff. They give way and they give inches to conservative elements of government, and then the conservatives just, they get an inch and they take a mile, really.
Right.
But that's what we've said before. Like, conservatives and right-wingers are great at that. Like, they don't get embarrassed by civility politics in the way that dumb liberals do.
Right.
They don't care about that shit. They know that they have a unified political platform. They know they want to, you know, decrease regulation. They want to free up capital. They want to, you know, make things easier for large corporations, because those are the major interest groups that run the government. So it makes sense when you look at it from that perspective that, you know, our government isn't almost entirely right wing. And to think of like Obama as separate from Trump, I think, is sort of a misnomer in a sense. Like, they're really no different. It's become a trope at this point, but we say, you know, Obama deported more people than Trump ever has. I mean, granted, Trump hasn't been in office that long compared to Obama, but when you say that to liberals, they will literally freak out.
Right.
You know, and they'll fact check you. And then when they see that you're right, they'll still try to come up with responses for how, like, it's different, though.
I mean, I think it's different in the sense that Obama was cruise control and Trump was going 150 fucking miles per hour towards the wall, right?
I mean, that's civility politics right there. Right. They don't care about what ultimately happens or what the platform is. They just want to be civil about it. And that's the thing with, like, never Trumpers. Like, they may say that they'd never vote for Trump or they don't want Trump in office, but why the fuck do they agree with like 99% of the shit that he does then?
You know, at least what I think more of, it's like, you know, in some of the ways that civility politics in the American center sort of like reinforce capitalism, like the capitalist agenda, more specifically in the modern age, the neoliberal capitalist agenda, the interests of the ruling class broadly is, you know, if we take an example like climate change, right? This idea that there is even a center to be discussed on climate change as if we need to hear both sides of this debate, because
there is
no debate. There is one radically out of touch group of people that should not even be holding office because of how ridiculous their views are on this matter, who have no interest in any science or the fate of the planet and civilization, or not the planet, but civilization on this planet as we know it, you know, being taken in the same consideration as people who are saying, hey, we need to radically mobilize our economy in a different direction, otherwise we're all going to cook ourselves to death. And in that process, by having that debate, all it does is stall anything from actually happening, or whatever does happen, you get like cap and trade versus like a Green New Deal, which would ultimately fundamentally change the ruling class power in this country as it relates to the energy sector, all of major finance that owns stock and trades in the energy sector and et cetera, like down the line. And it even goes in instances of like imperialism, you know, like something we've discussed in previous episodes, like Venezuela. Instead of you have one side, which wants to literally go to war, destabilize this country even more so than they already have. And then, you know, the sort of liberal center, instead of saying like, we want to go to war, is just like, oh, well, we need to condemn them and they're really bad people and this is his government who's doing this and not sanctions, but we just don't want the war part or we don't want the military intervention part. But they're still reinforcing the same exact class interest there in the unification of the two, and that something needs to be done about big bad Venezuela because they nationalized their oil.
But you know, if the U.S. does actually invade or do any type of like warlike activity on Venezuelan soil, you know that those same people that are supposedly against war in that very privileged centrist liberal position, they will just have such apathy about it that it's almost as if they're just agreeing with the more radical right-wing elements of government anyway.
Right. And then if you take other examples that we've talked about, like urban revanchism in previous episodes, it's like, if the Republican right wing in this country was bulldozing, you know, a black neighborhood to put a suburb on top of it, the American center, quote, American center, would just be gentrification. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's still a form of economic violence. It's still pushing people
it's
out
just
of
under the
area.
Rug.
It's just it's more aesthetic. They have one has craft breweries and the other has apple pie racism.
Yeah, and one place I really fear where the civility politics is starting to take hold, or probably has taken hold for a few decades, is in union membership.
Yes.
Now union membership is somehow offensive to the business class. Now it's like a thing you're not supposed to talk about.
Right.
I mean, it's always been something you're not supposed to talk about, but you get what I mean. It still continues to be something that is a little bit, you know, you're not...
Well, no,
but those are our rights, though.
There.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
those are our rights. I wish they had those same energy for our right to organize a labor union as they do for our right to bear arms or our right to free speech. Like, I need that same energy from these right-wingers on these rights.
And what I fear is that these companies, and they've already started to do it, is they treat strikes like an act of violence. They do treat it
because it is
like,
to them.
This is uncivil. This shouldn't happen.
Right.
And a lot of them, they really, if you look through employee handbooks, which I work in HR, so that's something I've done a whole lot of, is they frame things like right to work or anti-unionism. They'll frame it as something like an open door policy.
Right.
Right. Like, let us know if you have any concerns. Right. They don't want you to go to someone else. We like it when our employees come straight to us to discuss the issues.
Labor unions are really interested in Walmart and have spent millions of dollars specifically focused on us. I think you know by now that our company prefers to have open and direct communication with our associates. We don't think that a labor union is necessary here.
As if you're fundamentally meeting them on equal ground.
Yeah, yeah. And a
which
lot of
you're
times,
not.
Yeah, and you'll see it and go through your handbook. Check it out. They'll say, we like to take care of employee issues on an individual basis.
Right.
What they're saying is don't organize. Right.
Yes.
Don't ask other people about it. Don't ask how much someone else makes. Don't like dare to start a union and try to make things better for yourself. That would be uncivil. And I don't know if it relates directly, but to me, it screams of that kind of idea of civility politics. Like, don't shake things up too much. Just let's have a decent conversation and we'll give you that 10 cent raise. When in reality, if you had a union, you'd probably be making $3 an hour more, you know?
But Nathan, even then, like, you're talking about the capitalist class and them viewing this sort of like unionization as an act of economic violence and, you know, uncivil, which it is to them.
Yeah.
But then the alternative, you know, the actual liberal center on this matter is, for the most part, the unions themselves. I mean, SEIU and AFSCME and all these people aren't out here endorsing Bernie Sanders.
There are now 20 candidates in the field, but one rises above the rest. One candidate who echoes our stance on firefighter issues. That candidate is
Joe Biden.
And that's why the IFF's principal officers and executive board endorsed him for president of the United States.
They're not out there, you know, calling for mass general strikes. They're telling their workers not to strike. They're telling their workers to donate, you know, their money to campaigns instead of union dues. They're practically all ran by staffers. And then the only unions that you have the exception of that, like the flight attendants, you know, union, who's ran by an absolute motherfucking boss, or, you know, the National Nurses United or whatever. It's like you have a few here and there, but the massive unions, the Teamsters, the, all that stuff, they're literally in the pocket of the American establishment. And they have been since fucking all of, since Reagan, you know? Like, it's just, they've been so fundamentally crushed. They themselves have kind of adopted a form of, you know, capitalist Stockholm syndrome, where they're identifying with their fucking oppressor with the hope that they can get some crumbs on their table.
I think the unionism aspect of this civility politics is like very, very poignant and very important. Because if you look at what we're talking about here, where capitalists will see union organization as some type of economic violence. I mean, when did they start to see that paying people wages that they can't live on or can't save any money, or they're constantly caught in a cycle of living check to check, can't save, have no upward mobility? At what point does that become economic violence to the capitalist? And when you look at that, you realize they don't see that as economic violence because it doesn't affect them. It's fundamentally a class issue when we talk about these things, when we talk about unionism and civility politics. To a capitalist, union organization is going to look like violence. But to working class people like us,
it's liberation.
You know, it's liberation. But that's the thing about civility politics. It will get people that are otherwise well-meaning to look at these things in a vacuum and not see that it's a class issue. It's a class issue because, like I said, if you're not going to organize for your best interest, you bet the capitalists are going to do that. And you bet that they're going to shut down unions and make you feel like you don't have a right to organize a union or demand more equal pay or demand better working conditions. And that's what civility politics does in a real, real sense. So to that end, I mean, it's really a matter of people need to understand that there is no moral high ground. There is no low and high. There is no civility to be had with the political discourse in this country. Like, yes, we should be rational. Yes, we should try to be nonviolent in the way that we conduct our affairs first. But to not recognize the history of the fact that nonviolence only has gotten no gains without strikes, without other forms of shutting shit down, is to misunderstand history. And people from those pretenses need to understand you need to take a side. There is no such thing as centrism. Like, I mean, obviously there's a such thing as centrism because people identify that way, but really, like, it doesn't mean anything. It has no explanatory value, and it's sort of a negation of the reality that we live in, where people have class interests and they will vie for their class interests or work towards their class interests. And you really do need to pick a side. You need to realize what your class is and fight for your class.
As Marx once famously said, there are workers and there are capitalists. And in this society that we're in my opinion, as long as one class uses their class strength and power to organize all of societal's affairs, culturally, socially, politically, to keep the working people down, there will never be, and there should never be, civility between the two.
This is my fight song. Take back my life song.
Well, I think that about does it for tonight's episode. We want to thank everyone for tuning in to the Entry Level Left. We definitely appreciate all of our listeners, and we always want to hear your feedback or what you have to say. If you'd like to reach out to us, check out our website at entrylevelleft.com. You can check us out on Facebook at Entry Level Left. We're on Twitter at Entry Level Left. And if you go to our website or check us out in the show notes on Podbean or anywhere you listen to us, Spotify, YouTube, Apple, we're on all the major platforms. Anywhere that we post our episodes, you can get our show notes. In our show notes, we now have a link tree, and that link tree will link to anything you want to interact with us on, any social media we have. It's all in that link tree. We also recently started a Patreon. We'd like you guys to take a look at that if you're interested in supporting us monetarily in that way. Of course, we want to keep all of our episodes free for the most part, but this is a labor of love for us, and we do take a lot of time to organize these episodes. So if you do find value in what we're doing, we ask that you please, you know, if you can't support us monetarily, then at least share to your friends or write a review for an episode that you liked and just help us get the word out. But again, we appreciate all of our listeners, and we hope you join us for our next episode, and have a great night.